Welcome back to Lungcast, the monthly respiratory health podcast series from the American Lung Association and medical news site HCP Live. I'm your host, Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. If you're watching this on YouTube, be sure to subscribe to our channel at Lungcast and to get updates on new episodes and interview segments. And if you're listening to this on your podcast player, you can do that same there as well. You can also get more Lungcast episodes and segments at hcplive.com and lung.org. Ambient air pollution is something of a recurring national story this past year, with a myriad of West Coast and Canadian wildfires leading to harmful air exposure risks for many Americans. But as our country's focus on climate-related respiratory health grows, it's critical to not forget the impact of indoor air pollution just the same. Most people are aware that outdoor air pollution can impact their health, but indoor air pollution can also have significant and harmful health effects. The EPA studies of human exposure to air pollutants indicate that indoor levels of pollutants may be 2 to 5 times, and sometimes as high as 100 times higher than outdoor air levels. These levels of indoor air pollutants are a particular concern because most people spend about 90% of their time indoors. So today's topic looks at the indoor air pollutants for less visible pollutants than wildfire smoke, such as mold, toxic chemicals, asbestos. And we're going to focus and concentrate on a segment of our population who may be more impacted based on their age and stage of development, our children and their school environment. Now, to guide us through this, we are joined by Professor Mark Hernandez, who is the S.J. Archuleta Professor of Civil and Environmental Engineering and Director of the Aerobiology and Disinfection Lab at the University of Colorado. Dr. Hernandez, thank you for taking the time today.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So let's get into it here. Nearly 57.5 million students and school employees enter the doors of our nations every day. And according to the U.S. EPA, half of these adults and children spend their school days breathing air polluted with toxic chemicals, mold, viruses, bacteria, asbestos in some schools, pesticides, smog and particulates from vehicle pollution, and more. Now, before we begin to talk about the actual very important health impacts of poor indoor air quality, and with such a list of harmful pollutants, Dr. Hernandez, could you please tell us what you feel are the leading indoor air quality issues our schools need to deal with from a priority standpoint?
If we're going to look at it in terms of priority, and keep in mind the big picture here, I'd start with ventilation, where I'd just back up to say fresh air levels. And that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, given the list that you just recited. And probably, the number one issue is the amount of CO2 in the classrooms. That is the amount of stale breath that builds up during routine occupation. And that certainly trends with some of the other airborne particles that you listed on here. And I'm going to exclude smog from that, being that, depending on where you are, smog obviously comes from outdoor in, but many of the things that you listed there are actually generated by occupant activity. So I'd start with some proxy of fresh air levels, and that begins with CO2 measurements. So that would be the priority. And you see that reflected in the guidelines now coming out from professional societies, NGOs, and the CDC.
This follow-up question may impact exactly what you're talking about there. Some school buildings are new, some are old. We know some school districts are higher resource than others. What advice would you provide to school administrators on where they might want to start when considering the indoor air quality issues that they face?
Well, I want to address the statement that you just made about buildings in general, right? There's a huge diversity of buildings. Some old buildings are very well ventilated. They have, for instance, here in Colorado, we have some old school buildings with central shafts that are meant to be operated with open windows much of the year, and they have very good fresh air exchange rates. Some newer buildings have been designed mostly with energy in mind, so they're sealed up pretty tight, and they don't have great fresh air exchange rates. So what I caution your viewers and administrators who aren't skilled in building science is that it doesn't necessarily track with the age or the look of the building. It's really about how it's operated. And what I would recommend to administrators is you got to measure the air quality. It's not something that can be seen. It's skin deep. It doesn't track with the facade or the age of the building. So I'm going to inject the statement, and that is, you can't manage what you don't measure. And we have to go in and we have to do the measurements to actually figure it out. You know, the beauty of the building is skin deep. What really matters is the quality of the air inside. And the only way to consider what's in there is to actually measure it. And that begins with the cheapest, easiest thing to measure, carbon dioxide.
You make a great point that it's not the age of the building, and it's really how it's used, and the ventilation system you went back to at the beginning makes a big, big difference.
Well, so, you're a doctor. You don't judge a patient by how they look, right?
Exactly.
You measure it. You measure.
Yeah, absolutely. Metrics are important in everything we do. So let's switch a little bit now to how the indoor air quality impacts a child's health. We know from the American Lung Association, we have concerns related to the prevalence of asthma in our children. Nearly 1 in 13 children of school age has asthma, which is a leading cause of school absenteeism due to chronic illness. There's substantial evidence that indoor environmental exposures to allergens, dust, mites, pests, and molds play a role in triggering asthma symptoms. These allergens are common in schools. There's evidence that exposure to diesel exhaust from school buses and other vehicles exacerbate asthma and allergies. Can you comment on this further and also then go into the other non-respiratory health effects, such as those related to cognitive function for our developing children?
Okay, that's a biggie. There's several items in this, and I'm going to take them in the order that you presented them.
Great.
I'm an engineer and building scientist, and I'm not qualified to comment on the impact on child's health, right? That's really a medical issue. Sure. What I can do is back up and discuss, you know, the outcomes of epidemiological surveys that suggest, in fact, some of the numbers that you just cited. And unfortunately, in the Mountain West where I live, we're high and dry, and we have a climatic pattern and industry associations that our asthma rates are actually much higher than that. Many of our public schools, particularly in the urban metro areas, construction desk, industrial operations, petroleum refining, and so on, they've been implicated in the higher association with young people asthma in our part of the country. These are all implications. What I do know is that allergy and asthma triggers make everything else worse. From you know the most fundamental studies of just mixing diesel particles with fungi that are known to cause asthma to epidemiologic scales of exposures, particularly in urban areas, right? Where you have a mix of pollutants, everything's worse. And especially with young people, and we can't treat young people as small adults, right? Children are very different than our adults, and they're not little adults. So that really complicates the epidemiology around it. So from a building scientist aspect is what I want to do is get as much fresh air as a building can handle and is affordable, right? Bringing in fresh air means HVAC operation. It means conditioning air in the summer and the winter so that the occupants, students are comfortable. And it means getting the particles from the outdoor, what you qualified here, diesel soot among the many things that are lung irritants, whether you have asthma or not, is to put a filter on the system that brings in the outdoor air and put a good one. And that means you get the fine particulate matter out of the fresh air that you're bringing in. You get the good stuff, basically higher levels of oxygen, and you expel the bad stuff. That is the particles we're generating indoor, because we are all particle generators, whether we like to believe it or not. Do that. Bring in fresh particle-free air in enough quantity that CO2 and these bad particles don't build up. We remove them basically at the rate at which they're generated, if that makes any sense. And yeah, that includes the stuff, right? Bacteria, fungi, their fragments, and excluding the stuff from outdoors, pollens, diesel soot, construction dust, all the bad stuff. So it's actually a pretty simple concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, bring in fresh air, get the bad stuff that's out of the fresh air, mostly particles, in and displace what we're generating indoors at some rate. And what I'd like to comment is there is an emerging body of literature that suggests just CO2 alone, if we don't take the stale breath out of the buildings at a fast enough rate and replace it with fresh air, particle-free air, something that's not going to bother us, cognitive function is a real issue. We get tired easier when CO2 levels are high. Probably many of the adults watching this have experienced that. Cognitive function is you know, a very difficult thing to measure. It's not like an asthma prescription. So that performance, there's a lot of work actually focusing on that right now, but all indications is that when air builds up CO2, we're not as sharp as we would. Our learning environment is compromised and teaching learning effectiveness starts to drop. Very individual.
Right.
Very, very individual. Some are more sensitive than other, but the center of mass of young people, center of mass of adults too, do respond to that generally negatively, and you can feel it. At least I can feel it. So what's the answer? Better ventilation, get the particles from outdoors out of the fresh air, bring it in, and do so at a rate that's measurable and consistent. So this all maps back to the first comment that I made about you can't manage what you don't measure, and the guidelines are out there. CDC's mm-hmm. produced them, ASHRAE's produced them, and we've got a benchmark to try and hit.
Well, that brings up another question I have is, if these measurements are out there, how often do you think these measurements are looked at by the individual school districts and buildings? Is this something that is regulated, or are there local
rules? I wish it were regulated, and I'll come back to you can't manage what you don't measure.
Got it.
But I'm happy to report that school districts around the country are catching on to that. They're investing in this. Monitoring is not expensive. And we've broken it down to about $60 per classroom per year on a per capita basis. One of the largest school districts in the country has just deployed 10,000 air quality monitors, every classroom in the district, Montgomery County, D.C. Here in Denver, we've deployed statewide. We've deployed in Colorado. A couple of school districts in California, including Monterey, have deployed a significant amount of air monitors to get to this point. And what I'm also happy to report is the data shows that there's a lot of really good, high-performing school buildings out there. They're not all bad. And as a matter of fact, some districts have a majority of classrooms that are already meeting these ventilation suggestions. So I don't want to be doomsday about it, but what air quality monitoring does is give you a cost-effective way to prioritize in an evidence-based manner, where you see high CO2 levels, focus on those rooms first. And you can find out what's average, what are the outliers. And without monitoring, you don't know that. You can't do that blind. So monitoring offers a cost-effective way to prioritize the rooms that need mitigation measures to improve their air quality.
I'm curious, did you see much impact from the COVID pandemic when schools were noted that ventilation was important with regard to spread of the disease? Did that impact how schools looked at it?
Yeah, and I hate to say it on behalf of my profession, apart from infectious disease, we should have been doing this anyway, right? I'm going to use the driving analogy. I get into a car, I have a dashboard that tells me the performance of my vehicle, tells me how much fuel, oil pressure, temperature of the cooling system and all that. We don't have that dashboard when we walk into buildings, and we should. It's affordable, it's available, the technology's there. It was there before the pandemic, and the pandemic really catalyzed attention to, hey, these other proxies, particulate matter, CO2, suggest not longevity, But if there were something infectious disease agent present like COVID, more fresh air is better. And the other complications, if you have allergy and you get COVID, chances are you're going to get a tougher case of it. At least that's what my colleagues at University of Colorado Medical School tell me, and at Children's Hospital. So we should be doing this anyway. We won't drive a car without a dashboard. Why are we driving our buildings without dashboards? Great, that doesn't make sense. Yeah. And especially for young people in school, they don't have a choice to be there. As adults, we do, right? We can choose not to go in a building. We can work remotely. We can put a HEPA filter or do some mitigation strategy in our office or wherever, our corner of the world. The kids don't get that option. Mm-hmm. So they, of anybody, deserve a dashboard that tells them real time, or the administrators and facility managers, what the air quality condition is in their classroom. And I believe it's the responsibility of the facilities managers to make sure that that's as good as it can be under any given condition. It's affordable, available here and now. We should do it. And we've got leaders doing it.
Great.
Boston, Montgomery County, Denver Public Schools, among them. Big school districts are now moving to do this.
And it sounds like, again, a point that the American Lung Association is always concerned about is the health equity issues across different disease states and different exposures. And I'm sure, again, whether or not a school district has the ability to put these monitors in place and change the ventilation system really depends on their resources. But we need to keep an eye on the most vulnerable in those populations as well.
So yeah,
great point.
That way, you know, if we monitor classroom air, at least we can know, and we could actually verify what you're saying or disqualify what you're saying. But the point is, whether you're from, you know, socially vulnerable or not, air is the equalizer, right? You don't have it. You have a choice about the water you drink. You do not have a choice about the air you breathe. And now that we can monitor it and mitigate it, even with the simplest thing, an in-room classroom air filter, the state of Colorado just deployed 30,000 air filters in 30,000 classrooms across the state for that reason. And the air quality monitoring directed them of where to put them, where would they be the most effective. And again, if you know, do the math on it, if you gave up your pumpkin latte one day a month for your kid, that would pay for it. So I think there's a fallacy that we have to, you know, completely re-engineer or redo an entire ventilation system for a building. We don't. We have in-room mitigation strategies that are affordable, available off the shelf here and now.
Raising that awareness of the ability to change things without too much cost investing is a great point for our listeners.
Well, I think that's what scared us away in the past.
Right.
Was that we just don't have the money to refurbish schools. And you don't have to have the money to refurbish all the schools. You have to find the problem and mitigate them on an individual classroom basis. And that actually is affordable. We're down to cup of coffee costs here.
I know your background as an engineer, so this question may be a little bit off, but in the epidemiologic studies you've quoted, are there certain things that parents and healthcare providers should kind of look for when they think that unhealthy exposure at school might be playing a role in a child's behavior? You mentioned tiredness. Is that kind of the main thing? Easy fatigability?
Yeah. I'm not a medical
person. I understand, right?
Yeah, I work with them. And I've worked with a lot of school districts. I've been in a lot of school buildings, met a lot of facility managers and superintendents. And, they're all in very different situations, depending on the district politics, how schools are funded and so on. But what I can say is that almost all of them I've met, especially post-pandemic, are doing something to resource their districts to get to this issue, right? Normalizing social vulnerability, trying to find, prioritize what are my problems in my buildings and moving resources to do that rather than responding to generalized symptoms. And again, health practitioners, I think data from the schools can help health practitioners. I'm not sure that engineers looking for clusters of symptoms or other indicators are a good way to go. And I refrain from doing that. I just use the indicators in the classrooms and try to normalize that and help the supers and facility managers improve the air quality as best they can. Right now, we're actually doing the study of absenteeism in conjunction with the University of Colorado Medical School to get to the very point. Does improved air quality that we measure over many semesters actually result in lowered absenteeism associated with respiratory effects? So we're in the throes of doing that. And that's where I see us staying, right? Working with the medical community to look at this as a public health, not an individual, or even down to a cluster level.
And that feeds right into my next question. It sounds like parents and or healthcare providers who want to or who should get involved advocating for improved air quality sounds like it's an important thing to do. Is that,
yes,
from your standpoint, a goal?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm a parent, and I want to know what's going on. And Boston's a great example. They actually have a live dashboard where you can see indoor air quality in the schools, real time. Now, what I want to caution parents and those not skilled in building science or these types of things is, looking at this as a short term thing. These air quality issues are long term exposure issues, and you can't be an air quality expert overnight. And if you juxtapose what you see in a school to the existing guidelines over long terms, that's where, that's where it's the most helpful. On an individual day, or not juxtaposing them to guidelines, and I hope they eventually become regulations, but they're now guidelines. So there's no legal enforcement path here, that we look at it that way. And we do it seasonally and on a case-by-case basis, right? Not, a school next to a refinery is going to be very different than a rural school or something like that. We can't compare those contexts. So very contextual, as all these things are, especially with epidemiology. But without the indoor air quality data, it doesn't matter. And that maps back to the dashboard. I think Boston's a great example of giving this information to the public and giving resources. So, hey, take a look at the school, but juxtapose it to the guidelines. Yeah, not each other.
The guidelines you keep mentioning, are those available and understandable to the lay public or to a healthcare provider?
Yes, I think they are. I think our professional societies, particularly the Architectural Engineering Society, ASHRAE, CDC, of course. There are now government professional society or NGO university NGO partnerships. One based at Johns Hopkins, another at Harvard. This is a very famous one that are looking at exactly this, saying, hey, we have a consensus around the guidelines. Air exchange rates should be this ongoing. Some days they may be lower, some days they may be higher, but ongoing, on a bulk basis, we'd like to see CO2 levels, particulate matter levels, these outdoor air guidelines modified appropriately for indoors, because indoor air, as you mentioned, outdoor air are very different contexts.
Well, you've certainly given us a lot to think about, and there is hope there. It sounds like there is good work being done in certain areas. A lot more has to be done, but I want to thank you for your time and expertise today on a really under-addressed subject. And as we all begin to hunker down indoors this winter, we hope that our caregivers and patient audiences alike take away a clear understanding of how important the indoor air quality is. And if you're interested in learning more about this subject, check out our episode on poor indoor air quality with Dr. Edward Rook and Dr. Charlene McAvoy from last November. And again, be sure to subscribe to and rate Lungcast on your preferred listening or watching platform, and visit lung.org and hcplive.com for more news and resources. Thank you again, Dr. Hernandez, for really a non-medical but very important aspect of indoor air quality issues.
Thanks for having me. I enjoyed the interview.
So until next time, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters.